you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst with your hosts, Mickey Desai and Susan Cooper. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. I'm your host, Mickey Desai. Very happy today to be speaking with Brian Jenkins. Brian is an executive nonprofit strategist, founder and president of Entrenuity NFP. I need to know what NFP stands for one of these days. Brian's done a lot of stuff in and around the startup space in general and is a champion of startup causes and nonprofit causes. Brian, how are you?
Very good. Very good today. Thank you.
Thank you. What does NFP actually stand for?
Technically, not for profit.
Ah, okay. Yep. As all this time, and I've never actually seen that as a designated acronym at the end of a business name. I'm used to seeing LLC and then
LLC. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just, right.
A new deal and a new day.
Exactly. So today we're going to talk about a number of different things. I know that the issue of supporting Black-owned businesses and diversity issues in general are a hot topic for everyone these days and something we should all be thinking about. But in your experience, why does it matter? And what's the best way to support minority-owned businesses?
Why it matters, in my opinion, is for several reasons. There's obviously the historical element of African-Americans' legacy of slavery beginning, in 1619 in this country. However, the historical element is always going to be the foundation for the reason why. But one of the things that I've discovered and have experienced firsthand is that what I say is called intentional disinvestment requires intentional investment. And in order I look at a lot of things from my experiences, that of myself, my family, and others who are in my community. And the one thing that my great-grandfather was one of the first Black men to own his own land about 100 years ago.
Wow.
Which did not happen in Southern Illinois. It's where we're from. My mom's side is from the southern part of Illinois. Uh-huh. And one of the things that he wanted to pass down was a legacy of ownership. And so he was basically worked really worked land for almost slave labor price. Let's put it like that. And he wanted to eventually own the land that he actually worked on. And make a long story short, he was able to acquire about 400 acres by the time that he passed, and he passed it on to his children in 1976.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was crazy story, crazy time. But the whole element of his last name was Duncan. The Duncan legacy is own land, own opportunities that you can. And so that whole idea of intentional investment and the sacrifices that he made in his generation helped propel and help sustain our family throughout many crises. We're not a rich family, but that provided a steady base of income and ultimately turned into investment opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so the whole idea of intentional disinvestment means that they were very intent on not having him own his own land and for him to actually continue to essentially be a sharecropper. Mm-hmm. But he intended to change that for himself, obviously, but also for his family so he could pass on the legacy. So those are models that I grew up around and saw. Didn't see it firsthand because I was too young at the time, but that's the legacy that we have in our family, that intentional disinvestment requires intentional investment. And that's why I think how the Black community, just like for our family, if we have things that are intentionally designed for us to be able to create a generational wealth opportunities, then we can change the economic dynamics in this country.
I remember when I was working retail just after graduate school, I remember being in my bookstore. I sold books and I saw a book by, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but it was mm-hmm. called Why Should the White Guys Have All the Fun?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And this was in the mid-90s. Yep. So, does the issue of raising that level of consciousness about what needs to change culturally, this has been going on for quite a long time.
Absolutely.
Why is it hitting a peak now?
Yeah, I think right now, because of some of the racial challenges that we've had in our country over the past several years, but ones that have become visible, namely George Floyd, and just the many, many, many challenges that have been that have gone on that are now caught on video. These things have always taken place, but now due to technology, you know, it could be streamed in real time. And so, but the challenges, I think, also for this particular time is when people often say, what can I do about that? And I say there's a very, very clear way to support Black-owned businesses, create what I would call relational opportunities when it comes to what we call creating capital connections, to say, you know, if you have connections to resources, why not open those pools of resources up, not just the financial side of things, it's also those relationships that you have with others that are in positions of power, authority. Obviously, you know, maybe there's a financial opportunity as well, but creating those bridges that are necessary to help solve some of the problems. And some of those problems can, in my opinion, can be solved through supporting Black-owned businesses, Latinx-owned businesses, Asian-owned businesses, and of course, women-owned businesses as well. So I think there's a huge opportunity that we are in right now to kind of change the direction that of things that have always been in the past, but where are we going in the future?
My devil's advocate question here is, what do we say to the person who looks at this effort to support minority-owned businesses and they think it's a means to push white people out of the picture? Mm-hmm. How would you suggest that I calmly respond to that person?
Sure. I mean, calmly, that's a good one. I think it's, you know, a lot of times, I think many, because of our country's history, many don't know that how affirmative action has always been in place for white males and white females, particularly when veterans came back from World War II, the GI Bill, the whole idea that you can get essentially a government paid education. You know what I'm saying? Is you can also have where I grew up in Waukegan, Illinois, there were sections of housing that were designed for veterans when they came back, and they were able to come in and buy that piece of America to begin to establish the middle class. Those are some things that were set in place for, at that time, for white men to be able to have a foothold on becoming a part of the economic system. A lot of times people don't know that those same opportunities were not offered to Black and brown citizens or Asian or people of color. So it's part of it is an education process, and to let people know, you know, kind of what is the root causes of why we're in the position that we're in. And sometimes you can do that calmly. And sometimes people, you know, facts are facts. You can, like you always say, you can have your own opinions, but you can't make up your own facts.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We talk about cultural education and what it takes to actually move a body of people from one way of thinking to another. I know that the Venn diagram of making those changes includes political push pressures, policy changes. So what can I do to help my community move? What can politicians do to help their communities move?
I think, you know, individually, everyone has to kind of figure out where they are, what resources they have. I think for me, in my experience, is the connections. You know, a colleague of mine who's an advisory board member years ago told me, he said, Brian, with my network of my experience of work and the network, he said, my issue is not being connected to capital. The money is out there. It's my ability to execute. And the more that we're able to execute, the more you're able to build up, quote unquote, your brand or your name. And that gave me greater levels of connection. So once you have those opportunities to connect, and that's the key element right there, is making be intentional about those connections. At the same time, you have to be able to execute your business model. So it's not like these are what I call earned opportunities based on, you know, on my ability to, and the team that I work with, to be able to execute the mission and the vision of Entrenuity. Then once that happens, it's being invited to the table and being introduced and then being connected. And I would say being intentional about doing that. We do consulting, and I told one of the rules, what I found is, like, if you can invest for every dollar that's invested into a white-led ministry, organization, nonprofit in a Black, brown, or Latinx community, find a Black-led ministry or women, you know, female-led ministry or a Latinx-led organization and invest three times that amount. Because one-to-one is not going to solve the problem. And that's so it's, when a person writes that check, there's a lot more, there's just a lack of opportunity for the Black or brown led organization to have access. So that's a key element for me, is access and execution.
Right. Right. And you have said in your notes here, you've said that it's best, you know, that we all need to coach, connect, and capitalize the C3 method.
Absolutely.
Is that a method?
Yeah, it's just what we do and what I've experienced. Mm-hmm. You know, part of my career has been the coaching, which is the training side. We do entrepreneurial classes, adult classes, youth classes, investment models. We coach and connect for-profits and nonprofits. But that's the training side. That's the fundamentals. You know, the fundamentals are the fundamentals. Then the connecting side is, once you've proven that your model can work, that you've earned the opportunity to connect, we are intentional about making those connections for people to connect to our network of for-profit and nonprofit leaders. And then the capitalizing is we're launching a deal called Moxie Venture Partners, which is essentially a model to connect for-profit and social enterprises to investment opportunities once they've been able to prove that they actually have a product or service that has a bearing in the market. So we want to be intentional about coaching, connecting, and capitalizing those entrepreneurs, those founders, and social enterprises.
And Moxie Venture Partners is a program of entrenuity. We haven't talked much about entrenuity. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I launched entrenuity in 1999 after being fired from my last job. I had been teaching in the area of youth entrepreneurship for about 7 years prior to that. And got the call that, you know, you are no longer employed. You're now a consultant. And so I decided to put those 7 years of training, primarily at that time, urban youth in Chicago, on the west and south sides of Chicago, and put those things into practice, launched Entrenuity in 99, was bivocational with another organization for about 4 years, and used that revenue that I generated to provide essentially the startup capital that I need to get Entrenuity off the ground, and then launched Entrenuity. I was full-time with Entrenuity as of 2004. So we are a nonprofit organization, 20-year-old organization based here in Chicago, and we own for-profit entities such as our coffee shops, our curriculum resources and tools. But we are a different nonprofit in the sense that a significant portion of our revenue comes from sustained or sustainable income, from our business income as well. That was my model when I first started. I didn't have all those connections, but I knew I could go out there and teach and earn those opportunities. And now we're generating revenue from as a nonprofit owning for-profits as well.
It's amazing. Was it hard? Was it a difficult thing to do to start up Entrepreneurity? And what was growing that like for you?
It was very tough. You know, I would first give all credit to my wife. You know, she always supported me, and to this very day supported me in this vision that I had. You know, I had no money, no resources. I had an idea that I just wanted to serve kids on the west and south side of Chicago. I'm highly motivated by my faith as a Christian. And so that was one of my key motivators. It's like, I came out of grad school from Wheaton College. I didn't want to do the traditional pastor thing. I'm not a pastor. It's not my skills whatsoever. You know, I basically came in and said, hey, you know, what can I do to serve? And I saw this opportunity and said, you know, how can, you know, we bring economic opportunity to the kids on the west sides and south sides of Chicago? And me coming from a Black middle-class family, I didn't experience some of the same poverty challenges that many of the youth and their families experienced, but I wanted to put my faith in the practice in a way that there was not a lot of guidance around. And so it was very tough, you know, getting up and running. And so it's kind of like, in my book called No More Nonprofits, you know, and it's a KNOW, you know, I call it the 70-30 principle. At one point, 70% of our revenue came from basically fee-based services. Only about 30% came from donations. And that was my model. You know, it's like, if I could go out there and earn the revenue to provide the products or to teach and to work with the youth, the adults, that was my model of getting this off the ground. And it was really tough, but eventually it led to being very lean and mean and learning how to run an organization. And here we are today.
Here we are today. What are five things you've learned that you wish someone had told you when you first got started?
Man, five things. The first one was how important, I've always been a person, I think, of integrity and character. but how important your reputation is. I call it the three T's. There's always, you always tell the truth, you always are transparent, and that will develop trust. And once that trust is developed, there is, unless there's a reason for distrust, it will open up opportunities. Like, I mean, I can say I've personally experienced that. The other thing I would say is how important capital is to a nonprofit. You can have a great cause, and that cause, believe me, I know you can live and die by that cause, but at the same time, that cause, you must be able to run a good business model within the organization. A nonprofit is simply a legal structure, is not an operational mindset.
Exactly.
And so one of the things that I always had, which I've learned, and believe me, I've learned this by making the mistakes along the way. The other thing I would say also is have a good set of advisors around you that are, what I would say is they don't always tell you what you want to hear, but they're going to tell you what you need to hear. And that was something that I've learned over time, is that the men and women who have been able to speak into my life, sometimes I didn't see the fruition of their advice maybe until I would say a year, maybe two, maybe 5 years later. But those fundamentals of being around trustworthy people who really had my best interest in mind.
Yep.
Really, really, really helped me. Another element I would say is have a good set of financials. And this is something that nonprofits oftentimes struggle with, but the whole idea of having, what I would say, financials, always have 2 to 3 years worth of financials available for your investor or your donor to be able to see exactly where you are. Financials speak, they just speak. And that's something I really, really value. And then the other element, the fifth element I would also add too, is my team. The people that I have around me, people that, you know, help run the operation, are some key people that I could not, we could not have grown to the point where we're at without a good, solid core group of people around me. And they range from the people who run Moxie, the, you know, our coffee shops. But, you know, the team is everything. And I do everything I try to do to support my team, ensuring that they have the tools and resources that they need to the best of our ability. And I want to be able to grow that, you know, one day. But I'm proud of the work we've been able to do to this point.
What kinds of things can you help nonprofits with these days?
One of the things I think is, you know, I think they, nonprofits should be able to tell their story. They really need to be able to tell their story in a cogent and in a concise way that invites the what we call our donors investors. We want to bring the investor into the story so they can believe in the mission and the vision of the direction where we're going. And that's something that I think that we can really help the nonprofit do. We can also, one of the things that we do in our trainings, we also work with families as well. So in my book, No More Nonprofits, one of the things that's come out of that is we had no more what we call No More Workshops. And those are initially designed for the nonprofit leader. We walk them through some of the fundamental steps in No More and all those things. And that's a pretty cool workshop. They learn how to read and interpret a 990, which most people just file. They don't read and interpret it. Right. Was one of the things that we walked them through and how to do that. But the other element that came out of that was our workshops that came from the families of our donors and our investors. And it was called Level Up. And it's a workshop that's designed for families to say, okay, I don't know what it means to be challenged to, I mean, I've never thought through what it means as a Black or Brown leader to run a nonprofit. What are the things that you face that I may not know about because of my cultural conditioning? And that came as a direct result of those families that have read the book and said, we want to do better. We want to learn what those challenges are. Those are two elements that have really been pretty spot on for us, and also consulting and coaching, you know, the businesses that we work with as well.
Brian, we are rapidly running out of time. Unfortunately, there's more questions I want to ask you, but
sure.
But how do I find the book? And if a listener wanted to be in touch with you to learn more about you and your work with Entrenuity, how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, they can check us out. Our website is Entrenuity.com. That's our main marketing site, and that's Entrenuity.com. If they want to check out No More, they can go to Amazon. It's on there. And the exact title is No More Nonprofits, Moving from Dependency to Sustainability. And the no is K-N-O-W. Right. When I started writing the book, I was ready to say no to the whole nonprofit system. But then once I started writing it, I remember, you know, came to me like, you know what? I'm not saying no to it. It just means that I need to know more about how this model and how this system works. Yeah. And they can always give us a call at our office, 312-842-3800 is our number. And that's the best way to start. Moxie Chicago, that's MOXEChicago.com. That's our co-working space and where we do a lot of our trainings and workshops here in Chicago. They can always stop by if they're in the Chicago area. We're in the South Loop at 1449 South Michigan.
Very cool. I hope to visit Chicago someday. I may come by and shake your hand.
I would love to have that. That'd be great.
Brian, thank you for taking the time to make this episode with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.